I'm Tom Jamison, podcasting editor for FHN Today. The following podcast contains accounts from experts and survivors of suicide idealization. Vivid testimony may be triggering for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Jen Patterson. I'm the director of student services.
And I'm Sherry McGaija, mental health coordinator for the district.
I'm Sarah Marsh. I am 41 years old. I am married and I have three kids. I'm a stay-at-home mom. What makes me passionate about being able to talk openly about mental illness is when I first started showing symptoms, when my battle really started was 1996, and it was something that was off limits. People did not talk about it.
And your age group, you're more apt to talk about it. Ours, we still really kept things at home, and we kept it within our house. And we handled it at home, and we really believed that you could fix yourself.
I am really lucky that my parents had some understanding of mental health and mental illness. My mom is retired now, but she was a ninth grade science teacher, and she had a student commit suicide in her classroom in front of everybody while she was teaching. This was probably 10 years prior to me being diagnosed with mental illness. So this was already something that was on my parents' radar. They had dealt with this. My mom had been in counseling for a long time dealing with the aftermath of this. So they were really sensitive to being on the lookout for signs of mental illness, my mom and her students, but then in us too. So I was able to go to my parents and they were really helpful and took drastic measures to help me get well.
What do you think is usually a teen's first contact? You know, when they think they're not necessarily in a perfect mental state, maybe they're confused with their thoughts. Who do you think their first contact usually is?
Research would tell you that it's your friends, your peers.
Yeah, Thomas and I talked about that earlier, and we know even just from having my own children, from talking with you guys, you go to your friends first.
Exactly. And that's the thing, because I spend a lot of time with my friends, like especially as an 18-year-old in high school, you know, I hang out with my friends a lot more than I do my counselor, a lot more than I do my parents, even though my counselor and parents are going to be a lot more educated and a lot more knowledgeable potentially on some of these things. But then again, some of my friends might be a lot more potentially educated and knowledgeable about me and how I feel. So would you think that reaching out to your friends is necessarily the best option for teens?
I think it is a great option, and I appreciate that as your community, you're more willing to look at your friends and say, you might need some help. And there's a lack of stigma there. And So from our generation, I think that you guys have so advanced in your thinking and your acceptance of people and knowing that your mind, your emotions, it needs to be healthy just as equally as your heart or your lungs. And you give it equal balance, the equal weight. So I think we just have to help you as adults know what is correct information and inform you well. So collectively, we need to be working together.
And I think for teens everywhere, because we know that you're going to go to your peer group, you're going to go to your friends, we have to make sure that we're doing a good job educationally, making sure that your friends know signs and symptoms. So I can be a good friend, and I also need to know when this is out of my scope. I can no longer help. I've listened, I've shared maybe what I would do, but now I feel like my friend is in trouble. My friend needs help. And so, I'm not sure that we've always done a good job with that, with the education part.
90% of kids, have a diagnosis that we know of, prior to dying by suicide. Mm-hmm. So it's visible. It's there. We just have to get really used to seeing it and asking questions directly so that we can prevent it.
My name's Maddie Dixon. I am 19 years old. I was officially diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder and major depressive disorder when I was 16 years old. But for me, it's kind of been something that's been persistent throughout my whole life. So my friends had kind of like known that something was wrong, but I think they were kind of scared to bring it up, which I feel like is another misconception that people have, where people, I believe, might think that, you know, oh, well, if you bring it up, then you're going to make them feel even more depressed. So people had kind of known, but no one didn't really say too much.
How would you say that we as friends, a close support group, or even, you know, like family, like parents to kids, kids to parents, how can we work to help those who are struggling?
I think one of the biggest things is by listening. I think really just listening and listening actively of what are people really saying when they're not saying it, and watching behavior and just being a good observer, and then communicating with others, reaching out to somebody who might have more information that you do or different expertise to help you.
I think I would say too, when I would notice complete changes. So I think Sherry knows me. I typically look a certain way when I come to work. If suddenly I'm a disheveled mess.
You don't shower.
I'm not showering. Yeah.
Right.
That would be a drastic change. And so when you notice some of those things that are so off and they're happening, it's not just a bad day like, oh, her alarm didn't go off today. It's like multiple days in a row, she would come up to me and say, shut my door and say, you know, something seems off. Mm-hmm. Is there something you want to talk to me about? Because I'm noticing this.
When something becomes your normal, it's so hard to realize that that isn't what's considered normal.
There isn't a hard and fast checklist.
But I would say if someone says, I don't want to be here anymore.
Absolutely.
If you're hearing those kinds of words, that would be a sign. That would be a warning.
I can't do it anymore. Yeah. I don't want to do it anymore. I feel so much pain. I want the pain to end. Yeah. Suicide and suicide ideation is often completed because people want the pain to end. It's not because people are saying, I want to die. It's that they want what they're feeling to stop, and they can't make it stop. And how they can make it stop is through death.
My suicide attempt happened in October of my senior year of high school. And by that point, I had already been in therapy and taking some medication. And, you know, we knew there was a problem. I didn't look the same. I had lost a significant amount of weight, and I just looked very sick. And I became just really desperate and hopeless. I felt sad all the time, and I believed 100% that I would never feel anything but sadness ever again. So, I'm a Christian, and I had to grapple with, you know, heaven and hell. And for me, I thought hell can't be any worse than what I was living in, and at least it would be different. So I made the decision to end my life, and I did it at school. And a teacher found me, and I don't remember a lot from that day. A lot of it's really fuzzy in my memory, but I do remember it was during lunchtime, and in my school, to go out the front door of the school, you had to go through the cafeteria. And the cafeteria was full, of course. And I remember being wheeled in a wheelchair through the cafeteria to meet the ambulance out front. And everyone was looking at me. Everyone, you know, knew that something had happened. And I think probably a lot of people thought, wow, did she fall and hit her head? Or does she have a heart problem or something? You know, some people probably did suspect that it was a suicide attempt or that it was related to my mental illness in some way. And then I don't really remember anything after that. I know that I was in the ICU for some time and then transferred to a mental facility after that, where I was there for a couple of weeks.
Death by suicide is the second leading cause of death in children. It's a big deal. It's not a minor deal. It's a big deal. And we need to take it serious and understand it all around us and be very cognizant of what people say and what they express. And it's okay to ask direct questions to your friends. It's okay to say, are you feeling hopeless? Are you feeling like you want to die? Are you thinking about suicide? When I say those words, it doesn't make you have those thoughts. I'm asking you those direct questions. And we need to normalize that talking about it and really asking pointed, directed questions is okay. That's what keeps us safe.
Yeah. So you would say we need to start asking questions once their symptoms go beyond the societal norms of being sad or having a rough day or a rough week. Because, I mean, everyone's sad here and there, you know, of course. But maybe their symptoms go beyond, okay, I just don't feel like talking today. Maybe they're dragging for a day. But then once it goes beyond that, you know, maybe they've been dragging for a while recently, even though they have no reason that is apparent to be sad. You know, once they have any kind of thoughts or they say things that may be obscure, like that's not just them being sad. That's kind of them like having a complete loss of motivation.
We all need a support system. So maybe it's those of us just letting each other know, I'm part of your support system. I care about you. And I care about you so much. That's why I ask you questions. And I need you to ask me those same questions too.
Thank you to the guests who joined in on this discussion. If you or a loved one are in need of help, please seek more information from the National Alliance on Mental Illness at NAMI.org. Or in dire situations, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-8255.